Good afternoon, Kallax. This is Sight Unseen. My name is Tani Katenjian. I'm your host. Sight Unseen brings you the words and thoughts of artists of all different mediums, talking about what they do, why they do it, and how it affects the world around them. This week, curator Ralph Rugoff takes us on a journey through the most recent exhibit at the Wattis Institute, titled A Brief History of Invisible Art. Seems like a contradiction in terms, invisible art. I mean, isn't the whole point of art its visibility? To a certain extent, that's true. But if we look back at the words we heard on this very show a few weeks ago, all art begins with an idea, and it's the idea that shines through an invisible work. As Ralph Rugoff points out, our perception of art pieces exists through our interaction with the work, the way we see and think about what it is we're looking at. In the Invisible Art Show, the room may seem a bit empty, but it's actually overflowing with concepts and documentation of ideas and manifestation of those ideas. You'll hear more about the exhibition and some music as well, this week most likely from Buzu Banju, which we're listening to right now. So stay tuned. In the late 50s, conceptual artist Eve Klein had a utopian vision of creating an architecture of air. Walls, ceilings, furniture would be made of air, and while these things would exist, they wouldn't necessarily be visible. In the early 90s, Italian sculptor and performer Maurizio Catalan claimed to the Italian police that an invisible sculpture had been stolen from his car. He was involved in a group show the following day and didn't have a piece to place in the exhibition. The police did, in fact, write up a report, not second-guessing his claim of theft, and the report was entered into the show. These are a couple of examples of what you'll encounter when you go to see the latest exhibition at the Wattis Institute, titled A Brief History of Invisible Art. As curator Ralph Rugoff states, quote, "Invisible art challenges our assumptions by emphasizing art's communicative abilities over its visual qualities," end quote. And maybe most importantly, it asks us to take a closer look at the ideas behind the work and understand the work by experiencing it, not just looking at it. If you walk into the exhibit, you may think there's very little there, but it's bursting with ideas and energy, and it's that intangible fullness that Ralph Rugoff was after. Here, Ralph explores to what extent this show was actually invisible, and how does context affect what we see.
One of the contradictions of doing this show, and something I realized very quickly in putting it together, was that our ideas of invisibility always have to be framed as such. You know, if you look at the movies of the Invisible Man, you have to have the clothing that's walking down the street, or a pair of shoes, or a mark that's being made, something that gives you a visual index and that gives you a context. So there's no work in this show that I could say is invisible, with possibly one exception. And even that has some manifestation. But they all frame invisibility in one way or another. The work next to this Maurizio Catalan is a piece by Karsten Haller that consists of two slightly shiny strips of vinyl on the floor, and the number four, they're about as far apart from each other as the lines you would find in a parking lot, and the number looks very much like the number you'd find in a parking lot. So there's a vehicle here that's absent, and the piece is called Invisible Vehicle, and it was originally surrounded by visible vehicles that Karsten had made for an exhibition called The New World Race. But this idea of, you know, absence and what happens when we're confronted with absence, how we try to fill it in one way or another, and how we try to impose or a reading of our own or respond to it with an interpretation of our own of what it might mean, gives a kind of a sense of fullness to this space. So that for me, whenever I look at these lines on the floor, it doesn't feel like an empty space. It feels like a kind of full space that's inhabited by these ideas. And that was one of my one of my hopes in doing this show was that you could walk into a gallery that was almost empty and come away feeling it was actually quite crowded, because the ideas you were encountering filled up the space. And so, you know, this is about the idea that you don't really need an object to command space, that an idea can also fill up and command a space.
Well, I mean, there are lots of artifacts in here, that's for sure. But, you know, traditional artists, or the idea of traditional art is that you must have something written onto something else or done onto something else.
Right. Here, what you get is documentation. And sometimes that documentation is only a wall label. There's a wall label that's across from us on the other side of the gallery right now for a piece by Robert Barry from 1969 that's just called Electromagnetic Energy. And hidden in the gallery is a device that's emitting electromagnetic waves. You can't see the waves, and yet your presence in the gallery is changing the shape of those waves as you walk around. There, the only clue that you have that this is going on, though, is a wall label. And I think what works like this also bring up is how much our relationship to art of any kind is based on faith. That, you know, it's a faith that's as irrational as any other faith. It involves a willingness to believe, to trust, to assume that there's meaning, and that meaning is scaffolded and structured within a certain tradition of meaning, or plays at least against that tradition in some way.
Now, this all falls under the kind of the invisible art movement, all falls under what I would imagine conceptual art. It's all about ideas.
It is all about ideas. I would never call it a movement, because there's never was a group of people who sat down and came up with a manifesto, and it's something that has periodically cropped up over the last 40 or 50 years of art history. And yet I think, you know, what these artists are doing is testing a kind of rhetorical limit or a definitional limit of what art is. That in a way, you know, expands our ideas of what art is and how it works very much along the lines of what classic conceptual artists were doing 30, 35 years ago. And there are works by some of those classic conceptual artists. I mean, two seminal figures who are in this show are Art and Language, the British group, who have a piece which is an air-conditioned room. But it's accompanied by an extremely lengthy text explaining why a room of cold air could be considered a work of art. And their work is very much interested in examining how it's linguistic definition that defines what art is and what art isn't. That without that labeling, and labeling in a very broad sense, I mean, labeling without an entire kind of discursive support, we don't recognize something as a work of art. But if you then, you know, use that support in a certain way, you can turn an empty room with some cold air in it into something that people think about as a work of art.
Or you could turn a urinal into a work of art. I mean, it seems like the same sort of trend.
Yeah, absolutely. Here, what they do, you know, unlike that piece of Duchamp, is they make it very explicit in that they include this very lengthy philosophical, that's a slightly humorous philosophical, because it's so absurd. It's like a Lewis Carroll kind of text almost. And the other piece is by Michael Asher, which you might be able to even hear in the background, a kind of very low hum, which is a column of air that comes down from the ceiling and is blown to about, you know, the middle of the average body, say, and it's something you only notice if you're walking through it. But it is a piece that plays off the walls in the gallery in a certain way. It suggests a kind of architecture in itself, in that the air actually maintains pretty much the shape of a column, and that's actually a very tricky thing technically to do. So Michael's work, you know, is in a way playing with your experience in the gallery as you wander around, suggesting a different path that you might take, a different form of space that you might think about when you're walking through it. So there's work by those kind of figures in the show, but then there's work by people like Jay Chung, who's a young artist, probably around 30 years old, whose work called Nothing Is More Practical Than Idealism which is a work he actually made while he was a graduate student at Yale. And for this piece, he wrote a script, he storyboarded it, he hired some actors, he hired a complete film crew, and they went out and they shot the movie over the course of a couple of weeks. Except there was no film in the camera. And the only person who knew this besides Che was the cameraman. So everyone else participating in this production believed that all the work they were doing was to produce this film. They had faith, in a sense, in the artist. They trusted him that this is what it was all about. And now all that we have as a documentation of that whole experience was a statement by the artist about what he did in one production still that was taken of the cast and crew together. And the artist with a kind of mischievous grin on his face looking at the camera. And for me, this is, in a sense, this work serves as documentation of an invisible film. I mean, that's how I think about it, that it's evoking this idea of invisibility through this absent, never-made object, which all the entire bureaucratic and artistic apparatus was constructed, but there was no product.
Well, when I saw this piece, I thought about the artistic experience being more important than the result, process more important than product.
Yes, no, I think that's absolutely what this work is about, and I think that's what a lot of invisible work is about. And sometimes it's artistic process. A lot of times it's your process that you have when you're responding to the work, trying to interpret it, trying to read it somehow. There's a four tables in the next gallery that have drawings and paintings on them lying flat by a Swiss artist named Bruno Jakob. For all intensive purposes, these seem to be monochromatic white drawings where there doesn't seem to be any imagery at all on them. Sometimes they look like just lightly primed canvases or linens or pieces of paper. And yet there is a wall label with very extensive titles. And in fact, all these works have two titles. And that's a practice Bruno's been making invisible paintings, as he calls them, for 25 years. And when he makes these paintings, he's using water often to draw the images. And the water then evaporates. Sometimes it leaves a slightly wrinkled surface behind, sometimes not. But he actually does draw an image, but at the same time he thinks about another image. And so the titles, the works have these double titles. One is a purely mental thing, the other is an image that was drawn and disappeared. But if you look at the list of materials he cites in making these works, included are energy, brain, thought. And he does believe that a primed surface of a canvas or a piece of paper can react as a kind of photographic paper in terms of capturing the atmosphere of a room or the energy of a person or even an animal. There are some wonderful photographs of Bruno holding up unprimed canvases in fields in Switzerland in front of horses and cows. But he also did this when his mother was dying, and he spent, you know, a couple of hours on her bed holding up an unprimed canvas for her to look at, trying to capture something of her energy on this canvas. But again, it's you know, you don't see anything. It's not about producing a final product so much as it's about this process. And, you know, obviously a lot of the meaning comes from what we know about how he makes these things and what's involved in it, rather than looking at an object and responding to that.
Well, there's another energy piece, so to speak, in this exhibit, which may be one of the most famous ones, which is the Andy Warhol piece.
Well, there are at least two more works that are definitely related to energy, and they kind of complement each other. One is Andy Warhol's Invisible Sculpture, which is from 1985, and is basically a blank pedestal. And Warhol, one night at the Area nightclub in New York, stood on top of this pedestal briefly, got off the pedestal, put up this label that said Invisible Sculpture by Andy Warhol, and walked off. It was basically a one-day sculpture. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of ways you could look at this, that somehow, you know, he's almost making fun of his own aura as a celebrity, and the idea that somehow that aura is so intense that, as with a saint, if you touch something, you've imbued it with this resonating energy, you know, and that is what we're beholding there. The invisible sculpture is what's left of this celebrity aura. You know, but in doing a work like that, Warhol, in a sense, is looking back to Eve Klein, who's represented in this show by some of his drawings for patent applications from 1958 for invisible buildings, buildings which would be made of forced air, that would have furniture that would consist of jets of forced air. And these things were actually tried out, and they work. I think they're just very impractical. But Klein was very interested in the idea that we could live constantly surrounded by a view of the horizon, that we could live constantly in the face of infinity, in the infinite, in a sense. But Klein was the first person to create a truly, purely invisible artwork in 1957 when he showed an empty room in a gallery. And a year later, he showed an entire empty gallery, but he painted everything in the gallery white, but otherwise the gallery was completely empty. But he claimed that these were impregnated with his own artistic and sensibility, so that these empty spaces somehow had an energy field in them that he said people felt, that some people, he said, could not enter the room because they felt it so strongly that they were somehow barred from entering. So Warhol, in a way, is having a more ironic riff on that kind of idea. And also, in a not dissimilar vein, is this work by Tom Friedman, which for me was also a really key piece in this show, which is an untitled work. It's also called The Curse, or A Curse. It's from 1992, and it's a pedestal that just sits in the room with nothing above it. But the wall label explains that the space above, that above 11 inches above the pedestal, is a cursed space, a sphere 11 inches in diameter. So Tom Friedman had gone to a witch, a practicing professional, and asked the witch to cast this curse on this 11-inch in diameter spherical space that rests above this pedestal. And in making this work, you know, I think he was really interested in how the meaning of a work changes if you know the history of how it was made, or if you know other histories that have to do with its making and with the artist. And so this blank, you know, this empty pedestal, which looks like just a kind of small minimalist object, suddenly becomes something else entirely. The same year he made this work, Tom Friedman also started a work that was called 1,000 Hours of Staring, where over a 5-year period he spent 1,000 hours staring at a blank piece of paper. And there again, you know, this question of faith comes up. Well, did he really spend 1,000 hours staring at it? But yet when you're staring at that piece of paper trying to figure out, you're also reproducing the work of the artist. So I think, you know, works like these that make you do a lot of mental work in response to what you're looking at, in a way involve you in something that's very close to the work of the artists who are thinking about this kind of work to begin with.
Well, I think the question of faith is a big one, because someone on my way over here asked me, well, how do you know these artists aren't hack artists? You know, how do you know that they're just not making these things up? So I guess faith is much greater than I realized when I first came to this show. You're listening to Sight Unseen, and our guest today is Ralph Rugoff, director of the Wattis Institute in San Francisco and curator of the recent exhibition, A Brief History of Invisible Art. Here, Ralph reflects on a piece he commissioned for the show.
Yeah, there's one other work I'd like to talk about, which is this work down here by Glenn Ligon. There were several artists in this show who I actually asked to make invisible works for the show. And Glenn, because he'd done a number of works about Ralph Ellison's novel, or in reference to Ralph Ellison's novel, The Invisible Man, was someone who I wanted to invite. And he thought long and hard about what he wanted to do. And he said he wanted to make a white photograph. And the idea that photographic paper is, of course, white, you know, it was a kind of redundancy built into it. But the title of this work is very important. And the title is, He Tells Me I Am His Own. And he and his are capitalized in this. It's referring to God. And it's a line from a hymn from the early 20th century. And I think what Glenn was thinking about is he wanted to make a white photograph, an image of whiteness as an image of the invisible, inasmuch as in a lot of Christian and Hollywood films and books, the image of the divine is a kind of white light. So that even our images of kind of invisibility, or at least divinity, are color-coded. That there's nothing, that even the invisible doesn't escape the kind of cultural and social coding mechanisms that affect every other aspect of our life. So this gets back to the idea of how you cannot just present an invisible object. You have to frame the presentation. And it makes very conspicuous how the meaning of anything is determined by how it's framed, and that something that is kind of sublime in one context can appear completely disgusting in another context. And that context may be the context you as a viewer bring to it and how you're looking at that object.
I thought you were going to say that it revisits the thought or the idea of faith once more, and that often faith, especially since in this case it's referring to actual faith in God or in some sort of religious idea, is faith in something that's completely intangible.
No, I think that's a really good point. And it does bring up that issue again. In a way, it's almost impossible to escape from that issue, even in, I think, the one piece, well, there are a couple of pieces we haven't discussed. Two of them aren't in this room with us. One of them is this installation by James Lee Byers, who died a number of years ago, but you walk through a black curtain into a completely dark space, and you make your way through that space and come out into the next room. And it's called The Ghost of James Lee Byers. And Byers, while he was alive, made a number of different pieces called The Death of James Lee Byers. But here, you know, that idea of faith, I think a number of people have told me that this piece blew them away, that they thought this was the most powerful piece in the show. And really, you know, when you're on the other side of putting an exhibition together and you see that this piece is just made out of black paint and smelly carpet and a black curtain, and an idea, though, and an idea that's triggered and predicated on a lot of our cultural predispositions, say our fear of the dark, our half-belief or belief in the supernatural and ghosts and spirits of some kind in an afterlife. So there are these childhood ideas that you also carry with you on some level. So that when you walk through that room, you may be just enough scared of bumping into something in the dark or of tripping or of running into someone who's there and you can't see them, that you have an experience that becomes quite full. And so rather than seeming like an empty space, it seems like an experience that's actually fraught with emotion, with thought. And maybe that is the ghost of James Lee Byers, that's something he's left for us among his other works. But there's another work that operates very differently, which may be the most invisible work of all in this show, and that is by the Welsh artist Bethan Hughes. And it's a performance work, and it's a periodic performance where an actor in the gallery is walking around the exhibition, ignoring all the works of art and the wall labels, but looking at all the other things in the gallery, looking out the window, looking at the ceiling, looking at the floor. And her job is to behave in such a way that she makes all the work seem invisible. And this is something that happens to us, I think, on a regular basis in the art world, where we go to an opening and no one's paying attention to the works of art in the show, or someone's looking very bored, and that person can make the whole work in the room seem invisible for you because they're so bored with it that they're ignoring it so effectively that it becomes almost impossible to see. So this is a very kind of subtle and playful piece. And there is a final piece in the show by Tricia Donnelly, an artist whose work has often looked at questions related to faith and played with questions related to visibility. It's a piece that only the gallery sitters hear. At unexpected intervals, the telephone rings downstairs and they hear a sound piece. And the expression on their faces when they hear that piece is the work of art in this exhibition. That a viewer coming in at that moment catches this expression, which is supposed to be an expression, ideally, if the sound piece produces this, is an expression of someone who's kind of in between two different places. They can't quite make out what they're hearing. They're not in the room they're occupying anymore mentally, but they're not quite at the other end of the line either.
Well, I wanted to refer to two pieces, but I'll refer first to Tricia's piece, since that's the one you mentioned last, is offered to have me use part of it. I can't capture an expression, but would it be a phone ringing if I were to use it in this sound piece?
It's true. We could call you up and play it.
So that's what it would be. It would be the ringing.
Well, it would be the sound piece that you hear when you pick up the phone.
So there's
a couple minutes of a certain particular sound that you hear. And I cannot divulge how that sound is made, but I will say it's a very simple sound, but it sounds like an extremely mysterious and kind of unearthly sound.
So it leaves you slightly unsettled, which is what the dark room piece definitely did for me. I walked in there, I hadn't read the sign, and walked right out because I was terrified because it was so dark. So there's that whole element of the unknown and kind of being not scared but just unsettled.
Well, I think we definitely associate, the invisible and the unknown. And I think all the artists in this show to some extent are interested in unsettling the expectations of their audiences. And to me, that's what's really fascinating about this work, or having you at least revisit and re-examine your ideas about what art is, what it can be, how far it can be pushed. Clearly, for most people, the idea of invisible art is a contradiction in terms. We think of art as something that we see, and that necessarily has a material form and a visible surface. And these artists are clearly interested in revealing how much art really exists as a kind of rhetorical figure whose meaning is completely up in the air. And it's fascinating to me because it is, it's a game that not everyone wants to play. I mean, I just watched a young man walk in the elevator, take a look around, and walk out because there's not a lot to see. And this is a reaction that I think, I expect will happen on a regular basis. And yet, somewhat as a surprise to me, there are a lot of people who also are incredibly enthusiastic about this show. I wasn't at all sure that that was going to be the case, but who get a lot out of it. And I'm assuming that those people are bringing a lot to it.
Let's go to Beth Ann Hughes's... No, we don't have to go anywhere. That's the magical thing about it.
But, no, the person just walked in.
To Beth Ann Hughes's piece. I guess... The reason I want to refer to it is someone asked me as I was coming here, well, what does make art invisible? How do you make art invisible? I mean, is it... So boredom is what you touched upon, lack of interest.
That's one way of, I think, distracting us from what we're looking... from what might be interesting to look at otherwise. And I think there are a lot of things, say, in museums that produce that kind of result in people. That produce a kind of boredom that makes it hard for us to then look with interest and really appreciate what we see and in a way that leads us to think about what we see. I think most exhibitions create a kind of pre-Copernican world where you are at the center of meaning and you're walking through spaces where everything is laid out for you in a very precise way. So it's visible. Easily visible, and you know exactly where to look and what order to look at which things, and you don't have to think about it anymore, and you develop a kind of robotic behavior, an automatic behavior in response to this. And I think all of these artists are playing with that and trying to undermine and subvert that kind of approach so that you do think about things from a refreshed point of view. But as I said before, this show is called A Brief History of Invisible Art, but invisible art always has to have some visible aspect to it, or at least something that you feel. In the case of this Michael Asher work, maybe that's the most invisible piece. You can look up at the ceiling and see the box for where this current of air is coming from, but if you're walking around the room, you experience the work really as a flow of air, a particular type of flow of air in the room.
Would it be a stretch to say that all art is invisible and without your interaction or interpretation of it?
Yeah, invisible in the sense of like wallpaper being invisible, or like the sense that someone who lives next to a waterfall stops hearing the waterfall. I mean, that we do have selective perception and we can block out things so that we don't notice them and, in a sense, don't see them or don't hear them. And, you know, I think this work very much calls upon the viewer to be an active part of what it is and what it can be. And in doing so, makes you also think about how that's true in all cases. So in the end of the day, you know, I think what the invisible does is it makes us rethink our relationship to the visible and how we respond and react to the things that we can see. It's an extreme case, that's all.
Those were the words of Ralph Rugoff, director of the Wattis Institute in San Francisco and curator of the recent exhibition, A Brief History of Invisible Art. For more information on the exhibition, please visit www.wattis.org. Thank you to Sight Unseeners Naomi Cancella, Anthony Bonet, and Tyler McCauley. To hear this or other voices that have been on this program, please visit radiotania.org. That's radio, TANIA.org. This is Sight Unseen on KALX Berkeley. My name is Tani Katenjian. Enjoy the warm, hopefully, weekend.